coordinator here at the Boise Center this year. I'd like to remind you all to turn your cell phones off, if you don't mind, the ringer's off. We're going to record the talk and the Q&A, and then we'll post them online if you guys have friends that would be interested in it, or if you'd like to look at it again. I'd like to, before I introduce our speaker today, I'd like to just tell you about a few upcoming events that might interest you. This weekend, our very own Eric Owens is moderating a panel on the debate over religion in schools with Linda Wertheimer and Catherine Stewart as panelists. They both have new books out on this subject, and that's part of the Boston Book Festival. Then next week, a week from today, we have Mark Knoll from the University of Notre Dame coming. He will be talking about his new book, The Bible in Early America, Colonies, Empire, Revival, and War. And that's a lecture at 5 with a book signing after. So hope that you guys, if you're interested in that, will be there. And then we have another launch here, same venue, same type of setup as today, on November the 3rd, which is a Tuesday. And that's with Ellen Messer, who's from Tufts University. And she's going to be talking about Pope Francis's initiatives, effective action on environment, hunger, and human rights. So if that's something that interests you, please sign up and come. But today, we're happy to welcome Furman de Brabander, who is a proud BC alumnus. He studied philosophy here at Boston College and then went on to study at the University of Louvain in Belgium before receiving his PhD in philosophy from Emory University in 2002. He's taught now at the Maryland Institute College of Art since 2005, and he's professor of philosophy there. His specialties include history of Western philosophy, ethics, political theory, and environmental ethics. He confessed to us that he liked Machiavelli and Spinoza a lot during our interview with him. And in 2007, he published a book entitled Spinoza and the Stoics. But today we're talking about his newest book, one that's just come out from Yale University Press called Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy in the Armed Society. And I encourage you all to take a look at that. And I also encourage you to take a look at two articles that he has put out this year, one in America Magazine and one in The Atlantic. They're both available online, and you can go to see them through the links on our website. If you go to this event page and click on Read More, the links are there. They're very interesting articles about guns in our society. So we're delighted to have you here today, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say.
All right. Welcome. Thank you very much. Well, I thought I would open with a little bit of a story to indicate my basic motivations or initial motivations in writing this book. The gun debate was not an issue that I was naturally drawn to. I was always aware of the arguments of the NRA, and I'd hear them kicking around in my head when I taught my political theory courses. And my students always seemed to be interested in them. So, you know, those arguments and a rebuttal of those arguments were always in my mind. And then Sandy Hook happened, and I was in the car with my children in the evening of the Sandy Hook shooting, and we were driving somewhere, I don't know where, and my 12-year-old son at the time, I have 4 children, 12 and under at that time, little children, young children, and the 12-year-old, we were planning his birthday party at a movie theater. He was going to go see The Hobbit with some friends. And, you know, the shooting at San Diego had happened that day, and we had NPR on. And, of course, the NPR was going over all the gory details. And my instinct was to turn it off, you know, protect my children. But my wife said, you know, you better leave it on, because they're going to hear about this anyway. It's better they hear it and ask questions of us. So we left it on, turned it way up, and then when the report was over, I turned it off, ready for all the questions, and there was silence. And then my oldest son, who's 12-year-old, he said to me, Dad, can I be homeschooled? And then he said, Dad, I don't want to have my birthday party in movie theater, because he was thinking of the Aurora shooting in Colorado that happened that July, where a guy barged into a movie theater and shot 20 people dead. And so it hit me at that point, you know, this armed society that we are readily, quickly rushing into is making us less free, much less free. And so I wrote a piece about that for the New York Times that night, sent it in. It was immediately published in the New York Times and got a huge reaction, a lot of it unfriendly. Anytime you write about the gun issue, you get a lot of unfriendly stuff, and I was telling Max beforehand, I don't read the comments, just ignore them completely, move on. because there's so full, there's so much animosity on this issue. On one side, there's animosity on one issue, on one side, and what verges on apathy on the other side, which is kind of weird and disconcerting. I had two other background as I was, you know. Oh, so I wrote the article for the New York Times, and a publisher said to me, you know, this is kind of a novel approach. Would you expand it into a book? And I said, sure. And so in researching the book, you know, I had a couple of background questions that came into my head. And the first was, you know, there's abundant public health data out there attesting to the manifold dangers of abundant gun ownership in this country. No one approaches our level of gun ownership. We have the highest civilian gun ownership rate in the world by a lot. It's about 88 per 100. The next in line is Yemen, with about 50 per 100. Max pointed out Yemen's in a civil war, right? And we have, so, I mean, public health institutions have these studies. The public health school at Harvard has these studies. Hopkins, they print them, they publish them. And there's data from other democracies, like England and Australia, that have implemented stronger gun control measures and have reaped the benefits. This gets nowhere. And then you also have arguments put forth by historians and legal scholars questioning the NRA's reading of the Second Amendment. The NRA likes to read the Second Amendment as upholding an individual and absolute right to bear arms. And legal scholars and historians have, I think, rightfully questioned that and said that the NRA is reading it wrongly. In spite of all this very persuasive arguments put forth by critics, they don't get anywhere. It hasn't damaged or slowed the NRA. And I'm going to put a point on it. The NRA gets stronger. The nation, you know, England and Australia, after their massacres, they implemented strong gun control. We go the opposite direction. Not only have these arguments not proved persuasive in damaging or slowing the NRA, what over the last decade, the massacres we've had have resulted in looser gun laws. The shooting of Virginia Tech in 2007, that started the campus carry movement, which I don't think is any danger of coming to Boston College. But for those of you who don't know, that means that 10 states now have it on the books that students or faculty on public university campuses can carry weapons to class.
Concealed.
Concealed.
Yeah.
Thankfully. Concealed. And so that Virginia Tech resulted in that. And then after Sandy Hook, of course, what was the response? The NRA said, we need more guns in our schools. We need to get rid of gun-free zones. We hear that again with the shooting in Oregon last week. We need armed teachers, which some schools have, districts have implemented. And in the year after Sandy Hook, there were a couple states that, you know, to great fanfare, implemented stronger gun laws, such as New York, Colorado, and Maryland. They made all the news. But the New York Times studied all the state laws that had been passed the year after Sandy Hook. 70 of those laws loosened gun laws, only 39 restricted them. So our initial natural reaction after the Sandy Hook was to make guns easier to get. And so that's the other doubling issue. That's the other doubling question, that's doubly questioning to me, or perplexing. What is going on with that? Then, of course, there's the other issue, which the president, you know, bemoaned after the Roseburg shooting in Oregon. He says, look, Americans favor gun control legislation. They do. If you ask them individual questions, they tell you, we support them. The biggest example is universal background checks. 90% of Americans support universal background checks. 90%. And yet that's precisely the bill that the NRA scuttled after Sandy Hook. Several states have been able to implement these, but I've argued in some of my articles that's kind of pointless. You know, what's the point in having universal background checks in, say, Oregon when they don't have them in Idaho next door? And you can buy a gun without a background check in a private transaction, take it to Oregon and do your damage. So you need it at the federal level. The NRA has been able to scuttle that. Well, I think it's not, you know, what's the answer? Why is this happening? The answer is not only the NRA. The NRA is very powerful. They are very passionate. They're very mobilized. They're very effective. They are also very intimidating. But that's not the only answer. I think the American electorate plays a very important role. And quite simply, the passion of the gun rights side has not been matched by the passion of the rest. And there are numerous examples, electorally. You know, I can talk about some cases where this has been borne out. And so, my question is, why is a shooting like Sandy Hook not enough to stoke the passion of the gun control supporters over and against the NRA? There is a, you know, is a deficit of passion in everyone else, in the silent majority, as I started to call them. You know, there are some people who think this might be changing, but I don't know. I hope so. In thinking about the issue, I determined that a lot of the success of the gun rights movement is due to its political arguments. And these have never really been subjected to scrutiny, which is really what I do in this book. There's one other book that does some of this, but this is the first book that I've really tried to focus on them. And I think these political arguments are the reason for a lot of the NRA success. The NRA magazine, I mean, in general, the argument is that guns equal freedom. And the NRA call, their magazine for members is called Freedom First. They send their members on freedom cruises, where members are told to vote freedom first. They have cornered the market on freedom, and I think they've done so with great success. They also offer the argument that the Second Amendment was written, that the point or purpose of widespread civilian gun ownership is to sustain and protect the integrity of popular sovereignty in a democracy. That sounds a lot, but it's really like this. Here's a quote by Andrew Napolitano that kind of bears out what this means. He is a Fox News commentator and a Washington Times columnist, not Washington Post, very important distinction, Washington Times columnist. Here's a quote. He says, "The Second Amendment was not written to protect hunters' rights to shoot deer, but to protect our rights to shoot at tyrants and to shoot at them effectively." So because of the Second Amendment, we have democracy at all. That's what they like to say. And you know, there's another interesting point you'll notice in there. There's no room for gun control in that view. You want to ban assault weapons? Well, if the purpose of the Second Amendment is to combat tyranny, you're going to need assault weapons. You want to ban high-capacity magazines? Well, again, you can't combat tyranny. And so it goes. So the gun control movement, which has redubbed themselves the gun safety movement, and I'll explain why in a minute. I think I applaud their work, but there's a big problem. There's a big problem when they're facing off against these political arguments of the NRA. These political arguments have no place for any kind of common sense, reasonable gun control measures. So the gun safety people say all the time, but these are common sense and reasonable measures. I understand, I hear you, but are you listening to what they're saying? We need guns to combat tyranny. There's room for nothing there. So that has to be taken apart. That has to be taken to task. I was reading this last night, fully 29% of Americans agree with the statement that armed revolution might soon be necessary. Well, in that case, no regulations can be reconciled with that. There is a third argument that the gun rights movement likes to offer. It is that the Second Amendment protects the rights. It protects all the rights we enjoy. Charlton Heston went to the National Press Club in the 1990s. He also gave famous speech at Harvard that made similar points, but he told the press club, he said, "You only do what you do because of us. You can only," right? And he also had another way of putting it. He said, the right to bear arms is the first among equals. What does that mean? That means you only have free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly because of the right to bear arms. So we all have all our rights because of that. So there is, you know, here's the point. So these arguments, they are effective because they put the gun rights crowd the gun control crowd immediately on the defensive. And the gun control crowd has to say, well, I can deliver greater gun safety, but I'm going to have to limit these freedoms. And Wayne LaPierre, who's the head of the NRA, he pounces on that over and over again. And so that's why they realize they need to change their name. It's not gun control anymore, it's gun safety. They're not about limiting freedom. Well, I want to make the argument that the NRA is undermining our freedom. How about that? and greater gun safety will increase our freedom. That needs to be heard loud and clear. So, I decided that a lot could be done for the cause of gun safety by breaking that argument of the NRA. They have cornered the market on freedom, and I want to undo that. They don't own it. They don't deserve it. And the way they're, and the armed society towards which they are pushing us is undermining at every turn. There's 270 million privately owned firearms in this country. There are open carries on the books in 40 states. Concealed carry is legal in 50 states and the District of Columbia. And Stand Your Ground is on the books in 23 states. And now campus carry is on the books in 10. And 14 other state legislators. 14 other state legislatures, not Massachusetts, but maybe New Hampshire, are considering legalizing campus carry. So that's the world we live in. That's the NRA controls the playing field. That's the armed society that they are rapidly pushing us towards. And I argue that in that scenario, our freedoms are undermined and challenged, to say the least. Am I okay on time?
Great.
So, I'll share a little bit about how I deal with some of these arguments. So, the argument that the Second Amendment was written to give a democratic people the ability to combat tyranny. I'll deal with that one first. So, the NRA, the gun rights movement, is full of wonderful sayings, and I'm probably going to quote a couple of them. And one of their sayings is that they like to say the Second Amendment is like a loaded gun held to the head of government. And you know what that means. I don't get any ideas, Mr. Obama. I don't get tyrannical on it because, you know, we're gun owners here. This is somewhat persuasive because it does have a legitimate intellectual heritage. Our founding fathers were, and the political philosophers that inspired them, they were genuinely worried about centralized government. And it seems that at least, you know, in part, the Second Amendment was written to assuage those concerns. However, the contemporary gun rights movement does no service to that reading of the Second Amendment, I argue, especially because, thanks, you know, look, for 100 years until 2006, the Supreme Court could not be persuaded that the Second Amendment enshrines an individual right to bear arms. It was accepted that it was a collective right to bear arms. In 2006, they were persuaded that otherwise. In a split decision, D.C. versus Heller, the Supreme Court ruled that the right to bear arms is indeed an individual right. First time the NRA's argument was ever validated. And then the NRA pushes the argument that it should be an absolute right to bear arms. Well, it seems to me that, you know, in advancing this individual right to bear arms, the NRA does no service to this view that the Second Amendment is going to help us with tyranny. It seems that a collective right to bear arms would make a lot more sense. The NRA, what do they have to offer us in the end of the day? They have to offer us a loose collection of individual gun owners. Now, they are frightfully armed. They have immense arsenals. But I find it less than persuasive that these guys could take down a tyrannical government. They are not affiliated. You do have some militias out there, but they're largely unaffiliated. How are these guys supposed to put the fear of God into centralized power and centralized government? And there's another point. This is no ordinary government we're talking about. The U.S. government has the most sophisticated and the most expensive military on Earth at its disposal. How are these gun owners supposed to take that down? Oh, they have arguments, and if you'd like during the Q&A, I can share them with you. But I'll leave it at that for now. It's quite remarkable, the arguments that they spin out. Here's a bigger problem. Gun rights advocates, they look for overt and obvious signs of government aggression and oppression. They warn of black helicopters in the sky coming to take your guns away, and Wayne LaPierre warns of black-booted ATF thugs, that's a quote, barging in your door to confiscate your assault weapons. ATF is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the federal agency charged with monitoring legal gun ownership and tracking the illegal flow of guns, and the NRA has absolutely gutted them in the last 20 years. And I can talk about that later as well if you like. But the point is that, you know, if you pay attention to political philosophers, and particularly contemporary ones, and Michel Foucault in particular, you find, you learn, and I think it makes a lot of sense, oppression doesn't necessarily look like this in modern states. It doesn't look like black-booted thugs, and it doesn't look like helicopters coming from the sky. It doesn't look like tanks in the street. When you get there, it's too late. Foucault, he's especially powerful because he points out that in modern states, a lot of oppression is exerted through surveillance. And of course, we live in a massive and growing surveillance state, and I can say that from experience because I live in Maryland right near the NSA. And the Baltimore Sun did a great job exposing some of the abuses of the NSA. I almost said NRA, NSA. Foucault says surveillance is a remarkable form of control because it causes us to change our behavior willingly. And so we seem free. In a surveillance state, you don't know if you're being watched. Like I give to my students the example, you're on Amazon, you're looking up books about Hezbollah. Well, then maybe you start to think, well, maybe I should, maybe someone's watching me. So you censor yourself. And why this is so powerful, Foucault says, is because you feel free and you feel autonomous. So surveillance is, this is the idea of surveillance state is pretty remarkable. It's, I mean, pretty ingenious. So it gives the illusion of freedom. Well, so, you know, the gun rights movement does nothing, has done nothing to combat the surveillance state. And the government's power grows in this war on terror in general, and the executive office claims powers it did not, like killing American citizens. And the NRA has done nothing, you know, to... So, again, the NRA says the right to bear arms is a loaded gun held to the head of government. Well, that has not worked, right? With each of President Obama's electoral victories, you may have heard, the gun stores were overrun, right? And one historian at the University of Dayton, kind of a disappointing academic, but he said that, you know, hey, look, see, that, you know why they're buying guns? Because they're warning this Democratic president not to get crazy and carried away. Well, that has had no warning to Mr. Obama yawns with all of their guns. And I argue in my book this is actually, I think, proven to be a very useful distraction, you know. While they're buying their guns, government watch out, the government is meanwhile expanding its powers immensely and claiming new powers. In fact, I'd like to put a point on that too. Wayne LaPierre, throughout his many remarkable speeches, which I would urge you to read, they're entertaining and terrifying at the same time, he says over here, you know, they're basically lists of things for us to fear, you know, reasons to be armed, and his imagination is impressive. But he routinely plugs the war on terror. That's in the most recent speech is this ISIS warriors coming across the southern border from Mexico. That's another reason. So the war on terror is already a pretext for government expansion, and here he is plugging it over and over again. So they are aiding and abetting this expansion of government that they supposedly abhor and detest and defend us against. To the other argument, guns make us free, guns ensure our freedom, protect all the rights we enjoy. Well, I argue that pushed to a certain degree, which we are quickly approaching rapidly, gun rights, in fact, undermine and threaten our other rights and make us less free. And in short, they promise to undermine the First Amendment protections of speech assembly. And that's why that picture that Max picked is such a great one. I'm building up to that. Guns do not invite speech. They chasten it. Who's going to rush into a heated democratic debate with those guys? You know, another example, another powerful language that you might have chosen, maybe the next time I come back. They legalized open carry in Texas. They legalized it the week after the shooting in Waco, where the biker gangs brawled, killed 10, 100 guns were found on the street, and then they legalized open carry. That's kind of sums up where we are. And they legalized campus carry at the same time. And when they were, the open carry protesters were guys with assault weapons. They would go down to the State House in Austin and stand there smiling in groups. Well, that kind of sums up well what I'm talking about here. Who wants to rush to engage them in speech? Who wants to rush? What do they mean for assembly? Guns of their nature are threatening and isolating. They communicate the message, don't mess with me, leave me alone. And by the way, the open carry proponents say that, right? What is the value of my gun on my hip? It is to deter a criminal. Well, guess what? It deters everyone else, too. So I'm thinking principally of open carry and the expanded presence of guns in the public sphere, but I also think a lot about campus carry. And I've been trying to beat the drum on this because I am a professor, and for those of your academics here, maybe you students too, what does it mean for guns? You know, what does it mean for guns in the classroom? I'm not optimistic what that means. I mean, there's a lot of people who are critical. University of Texas, they're having a lot of upheaval right now. The law is supposed to go into effect August 1st, 2016. That is the 50th anniversary of the first mass shooting at a college campus, which was the University of Texas, when the guy climbed the tower with a rifle and started picking them off. Purely by chance, that's the 50th anniversary. Purely by chance. But that should be enough. But in any case. You know, I think, so I worry, you know, professors in Texas are up in arms about this, and they're saying, I'm not going to allow guns in my classroom. And there's a lot of safety concerns, right? Students do stupid things, not Max and you and students here. But when I was a student, I did really stupid things. Sometimes they involve alcohol. You want to throw guns in that mix? Theft is the most common, one of the most common crimes on college campuses. You want guns stolen on college campuses? Besides the fact that the gun rights people suggest that I will whip my gun out in mid-lecture of Plato and gun down the assailant. And there is a manufacturer in Maryland that is helpfully making and selling bulletproof whiteboards and bulletproof shields for me and bulletproof backpacks for Max. Madness. But you know, there's all this debate about the public safety angle, and I think there's a lot there. What about the pedagogical and civic mission of the university? How am I supposed to engage very heated and sensitive debates on, say, Ferguson, Missouri, with guns in the classroom? I've been trying to beat that issue, and you know, I think that's very important that needs to be considered. This is, you know, the. John Dewey, a philosopher who spent time in Baltimore at Hopkins, he made the case that the classroom is like, that's where democracy takes place, that's where it starts, that's where socialization happens. The classroom encounter is not about a transferring of knowledge, right? It's primarily about socialization, getting to meet people from different backgrounds and different strata in society, so that you learn how to negotiate differences with them, and you learn how to negotiate differences with them peacefully. How are we supposed to do that with guns in the classroom? I think they're contradictory. Am I still okay?
We're getting to discussion time, so.
Okay, one more minute. Right. Well, I've said what I wanted to say about that. I would also, you know, so I think that, you know, the proliferation of guns out there and in public, in particular. You know, I'm not proposing to get rid of the Second Amendment. It's all these laws that are propelling guns in the public sphere that are very dangerous to our First Amendment freedoms. I would also say assembly. How is assembly changed when the Occupy Wall Street protesters have guns? What happens to assembly when the Black Lives Matter protesters have guns? I don't think protest is allowed. And three points I would, you know, say, you know, just towards to wrap things up here. You know, in democracy, in a democracy, peace and order are upheld by rule of law. And rule of law is something that is taken for granted easily, I understand. You take it for granted until you go to countries that don't have it. And I think we do take it for granted. It's rule of law that upholds peace and order. It's not guns, but the NRA would like you to think it's guns. You know, and what is rule of law? It's hard to describe, but it's this basic expectation that you're walking down the street and the person coming your way is not going to lash out and attack you or shoot you. Or when you're driving down the street, everybody understands the basic rules. The irony is that our armed society undermines rule of law. stand your ground laws are a perfect case in point. They create this kind of shoot first society where you have to suspect that the guy next to you might be like George Zimmerman, and he might think you're suspicious, and he's probably a gun owner, and he might shoot you. You got to be careful. According to the letter of stand your ground laws, it's only seeming to be a threat. That's all you have to do. The shooter has to just think you're threatening in order to be able to justify shooting you. So you have to be careful in what, you know, it means to be threatening. And so, you know, this is, I argue that the armed society is a dangerous flirtation with the state of nature, where there is no rule of law, right? Now, LaPierre likes to say over and over again, we are in a state of nature already, we're already there. Well, not quite, but he's getting us there. He's getting us there, all right. The NRA is creating that very world in which their arguments pertain. That's pretty remarkable. They're making their own predictions come true. It says, you know, the NRA says we need plentiful arms for our lawless society, and it does our part in ensuring that our society is lawless and dangerous. It combats and weakens universal background checks that would make it harder for criminals to get their hands on guns. As it is, they make it easy. And they have destroyed the ATF and the ATF's ability to hold illegal gun dealers to account. That latter point is not well known. The NRA offers or champions a misleading claim that guns provide power in a democracy, real power. And I talk in my book, I talk about, you know, how Martin Luther King showed that that is not in fact the case. There is real power in nonviolence, and it is perhaps or likely more effective in a democracy. As he pointed out in his letter to a Birmingham jail, from the Birmingham jail, civil disobedience leaves the rule of law intact. That's the genius of it. I disobey lovingly, he says. Violence does not. Violence really destroys rule of law. And what is this gun culture? Maybe, you know, this is where I will end. Where does it come from? That was also a very important consideration for me. What does it say? Well, you know, I do think we're at a unique juncture in U.S. history. Like, the gun rights movement is really enjoying unprecedented gains right now. It was only in late 1990s that Wayne LaPierre was saying things like, I'm in the mood for universal background checks. Now he's not. I think this gun culture, at least in part, is symptomatic of a deeply sensed loss of power in the American people, a loss of autonomy, a sensed loss of political relevance. I think there's an author, Dan Baum. He speaks of the gun guy demographic. This gun guy demographic is as follows. It's white, middle class to lower middle class, middle-aged, rural and suburban male. That's precisely the population that has seen its economic and political power wane over the last few decades. Baum points out, you know, they're suffering from lower stagnating wages, lost job security thanks to globalization. Benefits are gone. It has seen its power diminish relative to minorities. And then there's also Citizens United, which is elevating, according to New York Times, 158 families over everybody else. And so the guns, they lean on guns to make a claim to autonomy, self-determination, independence, and political relevance. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. Well, that gives us a lot of things to discuss. Would anybody like to start by opening with a question?